Welcome to the fire.
Welcome to the fire, boys. My name is Parker McDonald.
And I'm Walter Lee, and we'll be your hosts on this episode of the Southern Collective Hunting Podcast. If you're a new hunter trying to learn the basics,
or you're a veteran woodsman just trying to get through your workday, there's always a place at our campfire for you.
Speaking of the fire, we would love it if you guys would join our growing Patreon community and be a part of the best and only digital deer camp south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Come on. If you'd like to learn more, click on the link in the show notes. But for now, Walt,
welcome to the fire. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Southern Collective. We have got an episode I genuinely believe is unlike anything you've probably heard in the podcasting space. It's not often you get to have an original guest on, in the sense of I don't think he's been on too many other podcasts. I know he's probably recorded a couple, but he's got a unique product, a unique experience, and he's one of those guys that you just want to be friends with and do business with. You just want to support him. We've got the founder of Land Trust on, and Nick is a tremendous guy. I mean, this episode is chock full of really exciting opportunities and experiences. And I'm not going to give away too much more beyond that. But if you've ever thought about going on a hunt and you don't have land to swap a hunt, or you don't have the money for an outfitter, I think I've got a solution for you. Or if you're just trying to chase down some different turkey species, this is your episode. Lean in close. With that intro, we're going to distract you for a few minutes with our introduction. Parker, how you doing, buddy?
Man, I'm doing well. And you hit the nail on the head when you said, it's a podcast about experiences. And if anybody has listened to anything I've put out within the past, you know, however long it's been since I started the Southern Ground podcast, they probably understand that I'm not big on episodes that are trying to sell a product. Mm-hmm. I'm not big on I've never been big on working with companies whose main goal is to sell a product, right? Like obviously that's not fair. Their main goal is always to sell a product, but if that is their only goal, it's not something that I want to do. And it's not the kind of content that I would want to have my name on. Mm-hmm. Not a lot anyways. I think there's always a time and place for it. So I'm always really hesitant whenever I get a request or somebody says, hey, we should have so-and-so from this insert brand gear company, you know, whatever product. I'm like, that's not really what I like to do. I like to talk about experiences. Yeah. I like to talk about hunting, right? That's what we're all here to do. And so, you know, going into every podcast like this, I'm like, man, I hope that we can draw that out, like a good informative podcast that, even if I'm not interested in a product, I can still enjoy the thing. And we accomplished that with this episode with Nick, because we're not talking about a guy who is just a passionate hunter. We're talking about a guy who genuinely cares about the resource. And you can tell with some of the questions that we asked that were very pointed about what their company does in particular. And he had, I'm telling you, the best answers that I could have written up to those questions. And so I think people are going to like this. I think if you're a public land hunter, you're going to like this. I think if you're a guy who likes to travel and hunt, you're going to like this. I think if you're a guy mm-hmm. who is trying to figure out how to take his kids and get his kids into hunting, I think you're going to find some value out of this. So I don't think that there's really anybody who will not find something that they enjoy about this podcast. So I'm excited about it, dude. I really am excited about people hearing this.
Oh, I'm amped. I think what you hit the nail on the head most was the answers to the questions. You can always tell when someone has really passionate about something, but then it's really evident whenever somebody's passionate and they've put a lot of time into something and thought into something, right? Because there's a lot of guys that are passionate about stuff, right? And it's harder to sustain it to get the answers to the questions that he has. And you ask a question and it's like, that's a great thing. And here's our answer. And it's just there because it's well thought out. I think that's indicative of everybody we've ever worked with. And as of right now, when we're recording this, we don't have a deal with Land Trust. We brought them on largely because we thought what they had would benefit you guys. If a deal comes down the road, that'd be killer. But I just want to point out, you know, like this isn't a paid for advertisement by any stretch of the imagination. I got in contact with Nick, started chasing things down with him, got on the phone with him for several times. I mean, we fleshed out the details of things. I was very skeptical going into this process because I didn't want to just bring somebody who was going to take from this community. I wanted to make sure they were looking long term, and that's what Nick is. So we're going to say thanks some people right here that we have to do at the beginning of every show, and then we're going to let you guys hear from him specifically. So I think given that we are on the cusp of turkey, and turkey is probably the main thing we talked about species wise on this podcast episode, let's give some love to Honeycomb Custom Calls. Daniel is making us a series of small batch pot calls, specific ones that he and I have worked to design that he's now working with you guys and the full SoCo crew to get their feedback on these calls. And buying a set of calls from him, the SoCo edition, that money helps support us. And it helps support a small town call maker who has a huge passion and an even bigger heart when it comes to this community. So please check him out. If you're a Patreon member, you get a discount code to his entire website. We'd love to give that to everybody, but we're going to reward the Patreon members specifically for what they do for us in that regard. And I think you're going to see his face in a couple episodes.
Yeah. I think it's one of the coolest dude, like, when Daniel first posted that picture with the SoCo calls, and you see a logo you created on a call, and it's like, yeah, man, that's a neat feeling. But more importantly is that the call itself, that flipping JB special, is just top notch, man. Like, just like one of my absolute favorite calls that I've ever run. I killed a lot of turkeys with it this past season. Mm-hmm. And so I'm stoked about people getting their hands on it. I think it's mm-hmm. going to be sweet. But you mentioned being passionate and being like genuinely, like, his goal is to help turkey hunters. Like that's just who Daniel is. We work with a lot of companies like that, man. Like we do. I can say this genuinely. Every company that we work with shares mm-hmm. the trait that they are there for the customer. And there's the first people that come to my mind when it comes to that is Greg and Ernie over at Tethered, man. These guys are producing some of the highest caliber saddles out mm-hmm. there, and just recently announced a new line of retail saddles from the Grit line, which is pretty cool, man. I like to see. The thing that I like about that is they heard the customer say, mm-hmm. we need a good, affordable saddle. You know, saddle hunting is an investment most of the time, a pretty decent size investment most of the time. And there are other companies, one in particular who has tried to make a retail type saddle that's just hot garbage. And so there needed to be something on the shelves mm-hmm. that people could mm-hmm. get their hands on. And Tethered answered that with this Grit line with the Workhorse series, dude, and I'm freaking fired up about it. I think it's so cool. So I really appreciate everything that the Tethered crew has done for us, both personally and within SoCo, and the people who listen to SoCo. They're always the first ones to jump on giveaways, the first ones to do all that stuff because they want to help this community. And so huge shout out to them. We're stoked to have them on board as well.
Yeah, and along the lines of those giveaways, now that the Carbon Fiber Predator platform is out, we're going to be giving one of those this year. So stay tuned to that. I'm thrilled. I cannot wait to hunt out of one of those, to be honest with you, candidly. I mean, just the amount of time and product effort they put into what they put out. I mean, even solving the problem such as access. You know, you talked about retail. What that means is you're going to be able to go into your sporting goods store and sit in a saddle, which is the hardest barrier to entry, as I think getting somebody's butt in a saddle. Once you're there, you see the value, and all those preconceived notions are gone. And it's really hard to do that. It costs them a lot of money to do that teach and train. You know, that was an outreach thing that I think was, you know, really appreciated and really fitting for the time. And I think this is kind of that next step. So along those lines, that same quality and effort and thought process went into their M2 vest, which we're all going to be hunting from this year. It's a phenomenal option. You should definitely check it out. It can be used for deer, duck, dove, squirrel, rabbit, the whole nine. It's, you know, super functional, and it comes in bottomland. So come on. I mean, you got to have it. But Parker preferred it came in like a red and black flannel, but you know, we'll figure
something out. I'm just like, so I've been watching ATA stuff that's been coming out through this week as we're recording this right now. It's like the weekend of ATA, and like everybody's producing stuff in bottomland. I'm like, son of a gun, they done made bottomland too cool. Mm-hmm. like the hipster, I guess that's a hipster trait. It's like, it's just too cool. I can't do that anymore.
I feel like if you're wearing Realtree though, you have to have private land. Like you can't wear Realtree on public.
That's a weird.
Tell me I'm
analysis.
Wrong.
You know it. Maybe you're right.
Maybe you don't see right. Bill Jordan on public land anywhere.
I don't know. But speaking of companies that just released something in bottomland, Bowtech just announced that they're going to have some bottomland bows too, which is pretty cool. I got to say, that's like pretty freaking sweet. But speaking about Bowtech, I just got my Core SS tuned and ready to go shooting bullet holes. I think I shot 3 arrows before I had a perfect bullet hole. Mm. The guy, my archery tech, Jared, did it last night, and we were shooting it, and he was like, man, this thing is just so easy. We've never gotten a bow to tune this fast. Like, yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of the draw of this bow. Mm-hmm. And these guys have, they've knocked it out of the park. Bowtech has with the center mass technology mm-hmm. that it's got the all the different locks, dude. If I should have written them all down, because there's all kinds of different new locks. You got the time lock, you've got the grip lock, and you've got what's the last one?
Lock. The didn't huh? go 20 lock.
yeah, the didn't go 20 lock. The you got the bottom land lock now.
Yeah,
there's just all kinds of different options. My point is there's all kinds of options. Yeah. And once I was talking to Jared, once the main tune has been done, everything else, like I'm pretty much like good. I don't need to put anything in a bow press. Like I'm good to go. The only thing you would need to do to put in a bow press for is like your peep. And I think that's cool. I'm a fan of companies. As we said through this whole intro right here, we're fans of products that have the customer in mind, where it makes it, especially for guys with our lifestyle of kind of like this DIY, like we have systems and things, and they create products that work for systems. And I'm a fan of that. And so I appreciate all the companies that we work with. But dude, I'm talking about that freaking Core SS is bad to the bone. I cannot wait.
When your budget bow, right? And I say that with air quotes because there's nothing budget about this bow besides its price. I've got the Diamond Deploy SB. When it shoots that good, you know anything like with the main flagship bow is just going to be wicked beyond that. And I've had this Deploy SB for maybe 3 weeks. And it is already feeling like an extension of my arm, in the sense of between that and the Kanadi arrows, I can't give them enough love for this process. There was never any questioning my arrow as it was flying through the air. Like, is that a bad arrow? Is that a bad shot? Do I need to number my? No, you don't have to worry about that. Grab one out of your dozen and shoot it downrange, and where it hits is where it was supposed to have hit. You know, I've got a Carbon 1X on the way, and they're going to have to work to get this deploy out of my hand, because it is just, it's wicked, man. I really love it. So. Huge shout out to Bowtech and everything they're doing for us, and just creating a heck of a product. You know, we've sold like 5 Bowtechs here recently for them.
Really?
We've had like four or five Patreon members have told me here lately they've bought Bowtechs, and it's just really cool because
awesome.
You never really heard that name too much in the Deep South, and then, you know, people hear about it, they go and shoot it, and like, dude, this is wicked.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So
super cool, man. I feel like whenever we do a podcast with a guest like Nick, right? Like we're with a company, as I've said before, that does sell things. I just want to drive home the fact that guys like Nick and companies like we've talked about, like the reason why I enjoy putting them on a, giving a platform, right? Like the, that sounds different than what I mean. They have, they all have platforms. They're all great companies, but putting them on our platform, to me, like I value that so deeply. I value that they, run their companies with integrity. I value that so deeply. And I think it doesn't take long in this industry to get screwed on that. Right. Like first time you get a quote unquote sponsorship deal, you're like, heck yeah, I'll do whatever you want for a free pair of boots or whatever.
10% off.
Yeah. For 10% off. Sure. I'll sell my life. But over time you start to really find the companies and the organizations that, that do not run that way. They run with honesty and integrity and character. And that is, that's what I'm excited about with a podcast like this. I think people are going to hear from something new that they've never heard. They're going to hear about some, they're going to hear some fun story type stuff in there. And they're going to be able to, what I was doing was imagine, I was able to use my imagination and say, how can this benefit me and my future and my kids' future of hunting? So I'm pumped about people hearing it, man.
Yeah, me too. I think the kids part is what really gets me excited. I think the, you know, you and I are both on similar trajectories. Your kids are, you know, a little bit older than mine, quite a lot older than mine. But I'm already looking towards like, how am I going to get them places? How am I going to do these experiences? Because growing up, I had the built-in access to all of these things. He doesn't have that now. You know, my son doesn't have that land that I grew up on. This is that answer, I think, at least a part of it. It gives me the ability to go and do some of these things that my dad and I always dreamed about, but that connective tissue, that like middle person wasn't there. So I don't want to give it away because I feel like this episode is going to be an absolute banger. So unless you got anything else to say, why don't we go ahead and send him on?
I ain't got nothing, man. Let's do this thing.
All right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is one of those episodes that at first kind of feels like we're talking about a product. And through talking to the gentleman we have on today, I know that this is going to turn into an experience for you, and this is going to help you do some of the things you're wanting to do. And that's, you know, it's, you can go to any podcast and anybody with a product and 30 minutes will jump on there and tell you like why you should buy fill in the blank trail camera, right? And we try really hard not to be those guys. It, you know, you chose to support us if you're in the Patreon group, or, you know, you've subscribed, you're looking forward to your Tuesday morning podcast. And we want to bring you something that really feels like it brings value. And when I ran into this gentleman, you're going to have to remind me actually how we ended up connecting. But it was very quickly apparent that he has something that is going to make this hunting community better. It's going to make your fall much, much better. And it's ran by quality people. And that's kind of the backbone of everybody that we've brought on. So we've got the founder of Land Trust, which think of it. Actually, you know what? I'm not going to say this. I'm going to let you describe it because it's your product. But Nick DeCastro, dude, appreciate you coming on board. Appreciate you coming on the podcast and talking to us, man. I know it's a little warm where you are, but you carved time out to be with us.
Yeah, appreciate you having me on, Walt. Yeah, it's 30 below as we sit here today in Bozeman, Montana. So a little chilly. We've been pretty lucky so far this winter. It's been pretty mild until basically today. Last year was a lot colder, a lot earlier. So we're happy with it. I'm happy to give you a little bit of background on Land Trust. Frankly, the easiest way a lot of people describe us is kind of like Airbnb, but for, you know, hunting and fishing and doing outdoor stuff on private land. So, we have a lot of private landowners, mostly farmers and ranchers who list their land on Land Trust, and you can go and browse it and, you know, inquire with landowners and book exclusive access to private farms and ranches for hunting, fishing, and other outdoor activities.
You know, I almost made that reference, but I didn't know if that was like, the cheapen what you were offering. Cause to me, when I think about Airbnb, I think about where I'm staying to go do something. Whereas I think for you guys, I don't think this is necessarily where I'm staying to go do something. It's like I'm booking an experience.
Yeah, yeah, we are the experience, but it is an easy mental model for people. It's like, okay, yeah, I get it's a market. Essentially, what you're saying is it's a marketplace. So, but everyone knows it. And hey, they're like a $100 billion company, so it's not a bad comparison.
Yeah, Absolutely. That's kind of what I was thinking. I was like, man, if somebody ever compared my company to Airbnb, I'd be kind of pumped about it, you know?
We are not a $100 billion company. I just want to put that out there, but it's very flattering.
Nick, how many at the moment, like right this second, mm-hmm. talking like options, I guess, for people, mm-hmm. like, do you have off the top of your head how many listings y'all have currently?
We're probably around 500-600 or so.
Wow.
That's more than I thought. It's about a million and a half acres across 40 states. So, there's quite a bit of opportunity. We're growing every single day. Like, we put new listings live every single day.
That's so cool. I might be skipping a whole lot of what. Go ahead, Walter.
Go ahead, Barker.
Well,
I was just going to say, when he says that, I'm signed up to the emails. I'm getting emails. It feels like every day with new listings that pertain to my searches so far. That's not a sales pitch. It's literally happening every day. But go ahead, Barker.
Well, you know, I feel like maybe I'm gonna skip a whole lot, but I want to kind of go back maybe in a little bit and talk more about origin and kind of how everything got started. But the very first thing that I thought whenever Walter said something to me about land trust and about you and the potential of doing a podcast, the first thing I thought is like, man, how do you like an Airbnb that's a great parallel. But an Airbnb, a house is a house, right? Like it's not,
right.
It's going to stay there and it's going to be the same. With properties, pressure is the main reason people want to hunt private land is for the mm-hmm. fact of pressure. And if you've got people renting these properties, I guess you could say, or day leasing these properties, it seems like it could get a lot of pressure because the way that that's beneficial is they get a lot of customers, right? So that was the first thing that I thought of. Like, how do you do this with a resource like wildlife that is limited and it can be overhunted? So I think probably a lot of people are thinking the same thing. So just right off the bat, I want to hear kind of what you guys are doing with that, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And look, we're all hunters here and we understand pressure and, you know, limited wildlife resources and how wildlife reacts to pressure and all that stuff. So, I think it's to answer that, it's really looking at who our landowners are. Almost all of our landowners on Land Trust are multi-generation production agriculture landowners. So these are multi-generation farm and ranch families who have lived and worked on that land for literally generations. And many of them like the outdoors too. And, you know, they have very different incentives. You said customers.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
I would say, like, our landowners don't really look at it as customers because their primary business is growing our food, fuel, and fiber.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they do every single day of the year. This is an ancillary income stream, but it's very different than, let's say, like an outfitter. And I just want to be very clear. We have nothing against outfitters. There's amazing ones. There's also some terrible ones, but just like any other service provider. But there are very different incentive structures. Our landowners see this as like, hey, we can generate a little extra income on the side. This is not our primary thing. But hey, if we can allow some access and people can have some fun, great. We're going to keep working and doing our thing every single day. Whereas, and they didn't outlay any capital to enable that. So when you look at outfitting, you're leasing ground. So you're laying cash out at the beginning of the year, and then you've got to sell enough hunts to recoup that and make profit. And so there's very different incentive structures. Our landowners, again, have lived there their whole lives. They understand what good years look like and what bad years look like. I'll give you an example. Kansas has been going through a pretty bad drought the last few years. And we had many landowners down there this year. We'd see inquiries coming through the platform like, hey, when I come bird hunting, they're like, honestly, the birds suck this year. Like, we've had drought the last few years. We're just not going to do bird hunting this year. And we see that kind of stuff happen all over regionally. It's like, yeah, mule deer numbers are not that great this year. We're not going to really do any hunts. Why? Well, because it's the land they live on. This is their home. They appreciate those resources themselves. And they want to make sure that those things continue. And unlike where if you're leasing ground, you're like, yeah, we kind of shot it out. We can go lease other ground. Well, that's not the case for our landowners. They live there. So this is a resource. Actually, the profit incentive for them is to ensure it's a sustainable resource, just like their agricultural crops. So you have this kind of a natural balance. Now, you know, we also want to make sure, you know, through review processes. So just like an Airbnb or other platforms, you book something, you go out on a land trust hunt and you get to review them and they get to review you. And so, you know, if we see, oh, you know, not a five-star review came through, which happens very, very seldomly. I can think of like a handful of them that have ever happened. We can reach out to those landowners and say, hey, listen, sounds like you should probably like close that package out for this year and, you know, look for next year. So, like I said, I think the biggest piece that helps us protect against the idea of just like, oh yeah, I'm going to book it 75 days in a row of the season is because who our landowners are and the fact that they live and work there and they enjoy those resources too.
Sure. That's as an excellent answer, like a very good answer to that question. I think, you know, if I'm looking at it, that's, I like the idea that you talked about this isn't their thing. This isn't like,
No, it's not their business.
Yeah, this isn't their entrepreneurship. You know, they're not like not like a lot of people who do Airbnbs. And so just that fact, you know, that this is their property. Now, I know a lot of ranchers. I'm not necessarily personally, but I know a lot of ranchers do not like deer. They do not like the wildlife because they eat up their crops. They eat up their blah, blah, blah. And so I've been a part of properties where the landowner was like, kill them all because they didn't want any deer. Do y'all have like a vetting process that you go through for your landowners just to make sure they kind of line up with the values and some of the things that you just talked about?
Yeah. Parker's got the questions. I like it. So it's kind of long. I mean, everything is incentive structure, right? I mean, what we as human beings react to incentives.
Yeah.
It's very predictable. It's funny, you say deer, we often give the example of turkeys. So most ranchers out in the West are like, dude, shoot every freaking turkey, I could care less, right?
Yep.
They're in there, right?
Cutting.
Yeah, they're in there eating all my feed. Exactly. So, and we've had this conversation so many times with ranchers. And then we say, no. Like, hey, there's actually a lot of people who would love the opportunity to come out and hunt some turkeys on your property. And then the first year they list with us, they always think we're like nuts for saying that. And then they make $5,000-$10,000+ in a spring turkey season. They're like, holy crap, man, how do we have better turkey habitat? How do we make more turkeys? And is it because they're bleeding heart, you know, NWTF conservation volunteers? No, because it's a profit. It was an unrealized asset. Now that is a realized asset. Mm. And so it's just normal market behavior. And I'm not saying that they don't care about wildlife. Of course they do. But it's the same thing in that deer scenario where it's like, okay, right now they're just a liability to their main operation, right? Farmers and ranchers grow agriculture for their primary business, and wildlife like deer or elk out here or whatever are eating their profit. I mean, if that's like the most basic way to boil it down. So you're feeling that tension. They're seeing them as liability. Now with land trusts, and if you can monetize and make some of that money back and like, okay, cool. We can have some people who are respectful, who are passionate about this opportunity to come in and hunt, and we can make some money. Now they start seeing wildlife a little bit more as an asset and having that, like that resource there as an asset. And then normal market forces go to work.
I've seen it with hogs down here. We Southerners are like, flip a hog. Like, those things are stupid. Those are dumb animals, you know, and there's an entire group of people from, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, who would love nothing more than to come shoot hogs. Yeah, exactly.
We don't have them. Yeah.
And I've been out West. I've actually been to Bozeman and hunted turkeys there around there last year. And it is, you are correct. Like, people look at you like you're insane when you're like, you came all the way from Alabama to hunt a turkey. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, absolutely. And you do see with a lot of these people, these private landowners, we hunted on private land this past year, a small little piece of property, had the best turkey hunt of my entire life right there outside of Bozeman.
That's awesome.
And these people were like, hey, y'all can come shoot our turkeys. Like, we don't,
yeah,
kind of like a yard bird, you know, like they don't really care much about them. And so it is interesting to see that regionally. I've got another friend, his name's Slade, and he has a company called Trips for Trade, which is not the same thing, but similar anyways. And he says the same thing, like they'll have people trading turkey hunts or deer hunts for hog hunts. And it's like, for a Southerner, that just doesn't seem like an even trade. You know, it's like, yeah, you can come shoot four hogs, you know?
Absolutely. And we're moving more and getting a lot more in the South, and I cannot wait to be lit. We have a handful of hog properties right now, but I think that's just going to be a cash machine, because in most states there's no seasons. You don't need a hunting license. There's pretty much no regs. You can meet somebody at a bar having a beer, like, you want to go shoot some pigs, and they can go.
Whereas at nighttime, you can go do that if you feel like it in most places.
Yeah. So.
You feel like you're SEAL Team 6 out there with thermals. If you've ever done it, it is an absolute blast. We did one thermal hog hunt out in Waycross, Georgia. They had this big peanut field. It might have been a cotton field. And they'd poured a bunch of corn out there. And these are people way outside my tax bracket, but they all had AR platforms with tracers, with thermals. And it was the most beautiful pulled pork situation you could ever imagine. It was amazing. And we could not do anything with the amount of hogs that died. It's like your cooler was filled and you're like, what are we doing with the rest in the ditch? You know,
that's a dream hunt. I've always wanted to do thermals. I've never got to hunt pigs, but it's kind of what we're all talking about. We all want to go do stuff that we don't have access to. Like, we all want new experiences. And I mean, that's really what land trust is. We deal in experiences. It's not about outcomes. I think it's important to kind of like understand things you don't serve. So, you know, if you put in 10, 15 years for a mule deer tag or an elk tag or whatever, right? And you finally drew it and you're like, man, if I don't kill a 200 inch mule deer, I'm gonna be upset. You should hire an outfitter. That's what they do. Do we have properties on land trust where that could happen, where you could connect? Yes. But I think it's about the expectations. Like, your buddies can't go with you because they didn't draw the tag, you know, so you're going to go and like, you waited a long time, like hire a guide and outfitter and like, go get it done. Land trust is for people who are looking for high quality outdoor experiences without the pressure that you experience. All of us experience so much on public land. You know, if you go to our homepage, it says get outdoors without the crowds. I don't know about you guys. Like, I have three little kids now. I got a company. I don't get to go hunting that much right now. I have a 4-year-old, an almost 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. So like, I hunt a handful of days a year. When I go outdoors, to get away from people. You know, it's either with my buddies or by myself, and it's to relax, to not be stressed. And you know, showing up to an access point or a trailhead and seeing 20 trucks there, like, that, it kind of kills it for me. Like, for what I'm looking for. So the people who use land trust, they're looking to go have high quality outdoor experiences. They want just a piece of ground of themselves so they can hunt it and do it exactly how they want, not reacting to other people and what they're doing. And then also, I mean, if you read reviews on land trust, both the landowners and the guests, all they do is like gush about each other and how cool it was to meet each other. And like, the guests are talking about, oh man, the family was amazing, and hearing about the ranch or the farm and the history and how they do their operation, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of intrinsic stuff built into it. And those landowners loving to host people who actually appreciate the opportunity and look at their land with new eyes. So, you know, we're not outcome oriented. If you need to kill a big buck, a big bull, whatever, yeah, you could do it on land trust. But if you're not happy unless that happens, you should hire a guide or an outfitter. But if you're looking to have like high quality outdoor experiences with your friends or family on some private ground to yourself, like, we're an excellent way to do that.
So let me kind of circle back, if you don't mind, Parker. Mm-hmm. Did you want to build on that, or are you okay? Okay.
No, I was just before you go, Walt. Just looking through this website as he's talking about it, and he's talking through the experience of things, and I think that probably really strikes a nerve with guys who listen to this kind of podcast, because, Nick, most of our stuff is about public land hunting, and the people who listen to it are chasing that experience. Either they're chasing that experience to figure things out themselves, or they just simply don't have access to property, right? Like you were talking about, they just, so they have to hunt public land. And I think for a lot of people, the turnoff is like, oh, you said private land, or I got to pay something, or blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, you do. But as I'm looking through the website, I'm like, you're not paying much. I mean, really, compared to what I would expect to see out of something like this, I want to get that out of the way before we get too far. Like, open up for listeners to open up their mind a little bit, because it's not as expensive as you probably are thinking.
Yeah, I mean, most of our turkey hunting, you know, opportunities, I know spring turkey's around the corner, I don't know, $150 a day.
Yeah, it's like average.
A lot of people have to trespass
somebody's property. You know, like, yeah, if I would pay $400 or $500 for a weekend of hunting turkey, like, mm-hmm, comfortably. And I knew there were birds there, and I was able to talk with the guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, guys, I think that, you know, there's two things here. We're kind of like, we're going to lean into this whole like DIY private, because that's really what we are.
Yeah.
It's not outfitted. It's not guided. You're just getting access. It's DIY private. And it's way more affordable than guides, outfitters, obviously way more affordable than annual leases, way more affordable than buying ground, which, you know, I don't own any ground. And it's like, I think the other thing here too is public land hunting isn't free. So yes, it is free to walk onto that ground. But I think all of us, and myself included, you guys, everyone who listens, who's hunted a lot of public ground, I don't know, it costs a little bit of money to drive all around God's green earth, checking every public spot and showing up and seeing 10, 15 trucks there and going to the next spot. And that's time away from your family, which I have very limited of that for my wife, or time away from work, miles on your truck, fuel, all that kind of stuff. And I often tell a story of one of my good buddies here, who's a native Montanan. And when I first started telling him about this before I started the company, he's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to pay to hunt. No thanks. And I think we were just catching up the other day. In the last 3 years, he's not hunted public. He's only hunted land trust hunts with his own money. It's not like I'm giving him stuff. And he's like, I think about it now. He's got two young kids now. And he's like, when I think back about it, every single weekend of season I was gone, I was driving 1,000 freaking miles, putting that on my truck. My truck gets 10 miles a gallon or whatever. And time away from home, like, it's expensive. Like, again, this whole idea that public land hunting is free and, you know, something like land trust costs money. Yes, it is free to walk onto the ground, but that's, mm-hmm, that's the only thing that's free.
And let me tell anybody who's ever been out west, or who's never been out west to hunt turkeys specifically, when you get onto the public and you see every person from the South, every turkey hunter in the South goes out west, it seems like, in May. And so, like, you're not seeing any residents. You're seeing, mm-hmm, all people from Georgia, Arkansas, Alabama, Tennessee, you know, all these guys. You will gladly pay $100 a day, $150, $200 a day. And I've never been on a Western trip where I wasn't willing to. If I saw a turkey out in a field on private land, I would have been willing to pay $100, $150 to go hunt that turkey for that day. And most people are. Most people who I've been with are like, $150? Heck yeah, let's go.
Well, think about how much money it took you to get to here, right?
Yeah, so, like, exactly.
We have tons of people who use land trust. By the way, turkey hunting is probably the number one activity on land trust. But the amount of people that drive from Missouri, Alabama, like the South, Southeast to Montana, like, you already made this huge investment of time and money. And, like, this is like a marginal expense compared to, like, getting yourself to Montana to hunt turkeys, or, you know, Nebraska or North, whatever, right?
I'm in an interesting position right now, because everything in my head is like, don't tell anyone about this.
Dude, every time he says turkey hunting is so cheap on this platform, I'm like, why? Why would you say that? Like, mule deer hunting is the number one option on land trust. In fact, it's a one, get one sale free on land trust. For that's going to be the real. That's going to be the real we're going to put out there to counteract this.
The cool thing is we have a ton of turkey hunting on them. We have a ton of turkey hunting opportunities on the platform. So there's more than enough to go around.
It's hard, man. I have this feeling whenever we produce anything about public land hunting, and, you know, there's always or guys I know out west dealing with point creep because of the promotion of some of these areas and some of these, mm-hmm, places and some of these resources. There are some things that have happened from it. And so anytime, as a podcast host, anytime we find something that's like, wow, I could see myself benefiting from something like this. And I'm like, oh, we can't tell everyone about it. Otherwise, you know, it's going to become more expensive or something. But, so tell me how you guys are kind of combating that, because it does seem like it could get, when the enough people hear about it, it could get like overpopulated. I'm sorry, Walt. I just keep like, I know you had a direction that you wanted to go, but I'm like, I'm kind of geeking out about
this. These are good questions.
These are all questions we were going to address. But I think what you just talked about, though, is one of the reasons why I wanted to have him on, is because the number one reason why Public, in my opinion, right? Nobody from the panhandle of Florida. The number one reason why Public is so hard to hunt right now isn't because we popularized it, but because we've lost access to private land. I literally remember $5 and $10 an acre leases in Georgia. You cannot find that. That's a buddy deal. That's like granddad saying, yeah, I want something on the books to make this formal kind of deal, right? And so this is what excites me so much about land trust, is because I've got a kid at the house. My wife's in grad school. You were talking about less time in the woods. I'm like, if I can network with a landowner and know there are birds there, and not have to work with 15 guys at the gate, I want to shoot a bird in all 49 states. This is my ability to make a very targeted, focused hunt in a couple states every year and knock it out. And I think this is a beautiful way, Parker, to spread that public access, because I don't know a single person in that Patreon group who wouldn't probably do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a couple things in there, a couple threads I want to pull on. So, Parker, with your question, you know, spot burning is kind of hard on private, because you can tell people about it, but it doesn't mean they can go there. So it's a very different dynamic than public, right? On public, you'd never tell people where you did something, right? Because you're like, well, anyone can go there. It's kind of like Tragedy of the Commons a little bit. But, you know, on private, the gating factor is always the landowner. And so, I mean, hey, we had a 202-inch mule deer shot by a young kid this year on a property that was $100 a day to go out and hunt. We can tell people about it, because it's private land. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to go crowd it. Maybe their packages will book up a little faster, but there's still the same exact number of people that the landowners want, maybe three hunts this year. So, you know, it's not as big of a deal from a quote, you know, spot burning stuff that you have to worry a lot more about on public. And I think, you know, Walt, you brought up a really good point. You know, there's some people out there who think that, you know, social media and podcasts and all this stuff is, you know, ruin hunting and there's too many hunters and all this stuff. Statistically, we don't even need to, that's a non-starter argument. We know the license sale data. It's not like an abstraction. Like, we know the exact amount of hunting licenses sold back to like 1950. There are not more hunting licenses being sold right now. In fact, per capita, it's going down. So that's not true. Now, has the DIY public landowner, was it on public? Has social media like made that a big thing? Sure, it has. But you're absolutely correct. We have fixed demand. There's not more hunters today. Sorry, there's just not. It always hovers around 15, 16 million, and it has for the last, whatever, 6 years. So we have about the same exact amount of hunters. We have less supply. So supply being land. 70% of the lower 48 is private. You know, so we talk a lot about public land. I live in Montana. Like, the Rocky Mountain West is pretty much where all the public land is. So fixed demand, shrinking supply, and it's shrinking because we're losing, you know, farmland to development. We're losing, you know, farm and ranch land to development, which will never be huntable land again, right? Have you ever seen a Dollar General get turned back into crop? Never. or a subdivision or anything else, right? So now we need to figure out, how do we unlock more huntable ground? And the only solution is private land. And so if you want to do that at any sort of scalable way, you need to have a private market model. It's just a matter of fact. Like, I often say, like, yeah, it'd be great if I would have never started this company if every door I knocked on, they said, go get them, Tiger. You know, like, why would I do that? But that was not the case. And I'm sure you guys and all your listeners know, like, door knocking is not super fruitful. And, you know, if you think a piece of ground looks good, probably 50 other guys do too. And they're probably going to knock on those doors. So, you know, that's why I think what we're doing is so important, because I don't know if you guys saw the Outdoor Industry Association just released like a 2023 special hunting report, maybe 2 or 3 months ago. It was right towards the end of the year. Across rifle and archery hunters, the number one reason, you know, like, detractor for hunting right now is like 80-something% is finding like places to actually, quality places to hunt. So it's actually like, where can I hunt? And so if you look at the, you know, from an R3 perspective, figuring this problem out is really important for hunting. And as opposed to some of the people who are detractors and say we have too many hunters now, well, there's a very well mobilized and well funded group of people who want hunting to be illegal in America. And this isn't like, you know, me being hyperbolic, like look around all the countries around the world who don't have hunting. It's not legal. So, and there's states right now who are making certain types of hunting illegal as a first piece. We need hunters because we need hunters to vote for hunting. You know, like skiing and golfing and surfing and fishing aren't going to go like be made illegal. Hunting, absolutely. Every single day, there are people working hard to make hunting illegal. So I want lots and lots and lots of hunters because we need hunters to vote. So if we need lots and lots of hunters, we need lots and lots of hunting access and quality hunting access. And public land is amazing. We love public land, but it's not going to support all the hunters in the U.S.
You know, you touched on a couple of things there. I disagree with you a little bit. I don't think we need more hunters. Not right now. Like, we don't need to too much more exceed our carrying capacity. I'm okay with that down the road if we make some changes. But what I do want, and I think it's a long-term strategy, even once we decide to increase the amount of hunters, is I need people to want hunters on the landscape who don't hunt themselves. And mm-hmm. what you're talking about with land trust, it does that. It creates – we have case study after case study about this. If there's not a financial incentive to have hunting on the landscape, it will not exist. And when hunting doesn't exist on the landscape, the habitat is not there, which means the animals are devalued. There is case study after case study of this being the case, right?
If it pays, it stays. That's the old phrase.
Right. That's exactly right. No one wants to pay, frankly, candidly, I don't mean this cruelly, but no one gives a crap about the gopher tortoise, right? Yeah. When you go through your day to day, you go to Dollar General, you get your milk, you wipe your kid's butt, you never freaking think about the gopher tortoise. Now you go to the zoo and you're like, man, I can't believe these things are on the brink of extinction, right? And it tugs at your heartstrings, and then you go back to Dollar General and you go back to wiping your kid's butt. And so if you have these landowners who don't care about hunting, but now they're given a financial incentive to care, now you have someone, when they see a bill or a newspaper article or somebody screaming from the rooftop, hey, they're trying to get rid of deer hunting.
That's right.
Now they have a financial incentive to do so. I'll take it another step further. You talk about how turkey hunting is the number one booking that you have. Marcus Lashley, on his most recent podcast, and I'm not going to speak to where or the regionality of it, but he said this one place, I think it was Nebraska, had seen a 40% decline in wild turkey. Nebraska is 3% private land. And if that's the case, we need private landowners to be worried. I'm sorry. Thank you. Public land.
Yep.
Then we need the private landowners to care about the habitat. What better way to have them care about the habitat than to be able to make some side money in the off season when they're not doing anything with something you've already said most Midwesterners don't care about, right? So we can knock out a lot and then go back to public land, spread the pressure out by letting people go off to Missouri and to Kansas and Nebraska and spend their vacation time there. That only makes that public land a little bit better for the guys who don't have that ability to have to stay close. It's a really interesting phenomenon that you're creating.
Yeah. You know, if you're a diehard public land hunter, you should love private land hunting. It's like, it's only a net positive for you. Hunting is kind of a zero sum game. You know, every day that someone is hunting on private land, that means by definition, they're not hunting on public land. So it's less pressure on the ground you're on, but also they're putting pressure on animals that are on private land and they will move, you know, animals react to pressure. The state of Utah did a study, I think 2017, 2018. They started to get a ton of complaints from people buying elk tags. I'm like, dude, there's no freaking elk on, you know, during season. Like, you're selling all these tags, there's no freaking elk. And so they started calling, you know, the herds, and they were seeing that, like, after the first couple of days of season, I don't know, like 80% of the herd was on private and they're just hanging out. And this is obvious to any hunter, like, yeah, there's pressure on public. They're going to go over there and eat the hay fields and not get shot. So they started doing private landowner tags. And then immediately they saw like 45% of the herd was on public during like the middle of rifle season. This isn't rocket science. They got pressure over there now. So they're moving around. So, yes, more private land hunting. One, 70% of the lower 48 is private. So if you want to solve access in any meaningful way, like, I want to work on the 70%. Now, there's a great organizations working on the 30% that's public. And, like, we want to make sure that hunting is still allowed on public lands, because there's a movement to make hunting not, you know, allowed on all public lands. there's awesome organizations doing stuff like that. We want to work on the 70% and do it in a way that is scalable and puts the incentives in the right places for landowners, as you mentioned.
Out west in I've hunted Montana, Wyoming, and I would still consider Nebraska. We were in western Nebraska.
And so I would
still consider that to be out west. And what you're saying is absolutely true, man. Like we were literally you'd see turkeys on the line, like on the property line of the public, and they would not cross that public line. And also we were around the public areas. It's harder to find access because people have been asking those people for access for years. And like, it kind of goes back to what you said. There's 50 other guys. If you saw that turkey, 50 other guys saw that turkey too, you know, and they've been asking. But they have these programs like the walk-in program. Plots is in one of them. I can't remember.
Weeha.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have all of that, which is in essence, it's kind of the same. It's kind of the same idea. And what I have found, is that those properties, are usually kind of out of the way. They're not super close to all the public. Most of the time it might be 30 minutes from the town, from the closest town. Whereas the majority of the National Forest public might be 10 minutes outside of town, you know? So they'll be a little bit more secluded, and honestly, like you don't have, there is pressure. I'm not going to say there's not, there is pressure. There are people hunting them, because most of them are open access, but they're significantly better than something like your National Forest or whatever. And as a dad, I got kids, I got a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Same stage basically.
Yeah. And, they're 4 and 6. And I only hunt public land. I don't have access to any private land. And so every year that goes by, I'm constantly thinking like, how am I going to get these kids into this without the access that I had growing up? Like I could get on a lease and that would be, and probably will at some point, but having the opportunity to go somewhere and have a decent chance at it, just seeing something. You know, just seeing an animal.
That's it right there. That's it right there. Like, you know, and when you look at, and we've talked to adult hunters who, you know, maybe it's somebody's girlfriend or wife who wants to try. It is not, and we've had a lot of like dads like us who are like, hey man, I don't feel safe bringing my kids out in rifle season. Mm-hmm. I just don't. And to get, I don't know, to get somebody hooked on hunting, it's not about getting them to kill something. Like that's great. But even if you just, if you're close to a deer or you see a bird flush or what, like just getting the opportunity to see that. And I think that is to me, like the best way to actually get someone hooked on, you know, get hooked on it and to not have to deal with I can remember being a kid, like dealing with the stress and anxiety when you're out hunting on public. And then there's other hunters. And then my dad is like, all right, well, I got little kids here. We were big bird hunters. So, you know, bird dogs getting fights, like there was just, all of a sudden it was just like stressful. And that changed the, you know, I still love hunting today, of course, but to have a controlled environment where you can introduce your children or someone who's new to hunting to this cool thing and get them, just get them close to wildlife, get them to see wildlife, get them to not have to deal with that stressful environment that quite often public land is. Yeah. And there's a lot of dudes who love playing the chess game of public land hunting and scoring, you know, on public lands. And that's awesome. But that's like a PhD level. Like we're trying to get people in the 101.
Yeah.
And, you know, like even where I'm at, I don't want to play that game. Like I respect the guys who do it and they're way better hunters than me, but it's not a game I'm interested in playing. I just want to go out and have a good time in the outdoors.
Your goals are different. Yeah. I mean, that's
totally different goals. Totally different goals.
My goals.
I respect them.
Exactly. My goals, up until I started hunting public land were really similar. Like I just wanted to go out and if I could find a spot that was like, if I could find a deer in a spot that hang my climber or my tree stand that was, you know, close to the parking area and I could put the corn pile out there and easily, like that was kind of the goal. But then once I lost that access or decided I didn't want to pay for that access, I learned on public land, I learned what I actually enjoy doing, which is that what you just described. Like, I like that challenge. I like figuring things out. I like, now I still am going to look for the easiest opportunity within that challenge to be successful. And so I like that. And I get that. I understand that there's going to be a group of people who are going to listen to this and say, nope, ain't for me. Cause honestly, like, I'm probably not going to use it a lot, but there are going to be scenarios where, I'm going to say, like, I want to go on a trip. I've got 5 days. Let's say I got 5 or 4 days to go to Oklahoma to hunt whitetails. You know, I'm going to be in Oklahoma for 5 days for work or something like that, where I don't have the time, number one, to invest into scouting a piece of public land, which is the most important part of hunting on public land, is having the time. Like, I'm not going to go out with a ton of confidence with 3 days on a piece of public I've never been to, and have confidence that I'm going to be able to even find the animals in those 3 days. Or that might not be true. I would have confidence I could find them, but be able to find them and execute and do all that. 3 days, maybe. Maybe I can. But I wouldn't take that risk most of the time. I'm not going to take that trip for 3 days. Now, if I've got 8 days, 7 days, you know, 10 days maybe to go on a trip, I'm going to choose public land because I like the reward of that. I like that process, but it's just that it's a process. Whereas going on a property where you are able to find or talk to a landowner that can tell you, they may not know anything about turkeys, but I promise you, they know something about what the turkeys are doing on their property. They may not know anything about deer,
100%.
But they knew the deer was in that field. You know, we saw a giant buck in the field daylight, 2 nights ago.
Every day for the last 5 days. Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that's right, Parker. It isn't, by the way, it's not all or nothing. It's situational. And it's like, I often give the analogy of like, Airbnb didn't kill hotels, right? And it never will, because it's different. Mm-hmm. It's a different use case for many people.
Yep.
When I'm going to go to SHOT Show, I don't want to stay at an Airbnb. I want to stay at a hotel on the strip. Why? Because there's restaurants there. It's close to the thing, room service. You don't have to worry about cleaning your room, all that stuff, right? But when I travel with my three little kids, I want an Airbnb because I want different rooms for them to sleep in. You guys both know, if you got young kids, like, you don't want them sleeping in the same room because one wakes the other ones up, and you can cook food and all that kind of stuff. So I look for different things for different applications. And you're exactly right, Bart. It's like, hey, cool, I'm traveling, or, you know, I got a three day thing and I want to go to a new state after a new species. I kind of want to go have a place to myself where, yeah, I can talk to the farmer rancher and they're like, I don't know, I see him over there every morning and over there every afternoon. Go get it. Like, you know, DIY private, right?
People underestimate how much fun, like, especially the kind of people that I was just talking about, like the hardcore public, I ain't hunting no private type guys. Let me tell you, for those, there is nothing to me. I mean, I'm talking about nothing more fun than having the knowledge and drive of a public land hunter and to go on a private land piece, a DIY private piece. Now, there's nothing more miserable than somebody telling you where to go sit, but there's nothing more fun than going out and saying, like, I know what's here. I know that this is a good property. I know the amount of pressure that's been here. I know I have this information that the landowner gave me. Now I can go put the real pieces together and be able to have that same experience and see maybe a quicker payoff or a more intense payoff. Maybe you see a heavier rut activity than you normally would on public, which is true. You're probably going to, but it's a DIY experience still. There's no part of it.
You get to play it exactly. Yeah. You get to play it exactly how you want to play it.
Yep.
And, you know, without the other pressure from somebody else coming out of nowhere. Yeah. And that's what I think this DIY private, that's truly what we're talking about here.
And it's fun. It is so much freaking fun, dude. When you can, like, once you have that foundation where you've learned how to hunt animals in a pressured environment and you can go and apply it on unpressured land, dude, it is so much freaking fun. I've had a few scenarios like where I've been invited to go hunt a lease or something where I've been able to do that. And it's super rewarding. It is not less rewarding to me to kill an animal on private land than it is on public, especially if it's DIY, because, like, you still did all the same things, you know, you just didn't have the human aspect, which is the pressure. You didn't have that.
Yep.
You still hunted that deer fully. You just didn't have the human pressure, which is, and it, dude, that reward is amazing.
Yeah, it's funny. In some circles, you're like, oh, it's private land. It's like, well, it wasn't tied to a stake. You know, like I've hunted a ton of private in the last 5 years and struck out. And I don't present myself as some like amazing hunter. I love being outdoors. That's like, that's what the win is for me. But like, there's still wild animals doing wild animal stuff. You know, you still have to be good at hunting to score on private. I've just also been deal with that one element.
I've been to public land that was easier than private too. You know what I mean? Like, I've had public opportunities where Nebraska is a great example. Quick payoff on the public in those places. And then I've been able to experience like in Montana where we hunted private land. That was the same type of experience that I was talking about, where you go on a controlled environment where nobody's killing these turkeys and you get to have the time of your life. Whereas, you know, Walt, you probably can understand this too. Like there was times in my life prior to having the knowledge that I have now and the skill set that I've developed over the years where I could have walked onto that same property and not killed anything. You know what I mean? Because I didn't have that knowledge. And so I think the coexisting of the two styles, kind of like what you said earlier, Nick, like I'm glad people hunt private land, you know, more,
yeah.
The more people that are leasing up the land, but the more people that are hunting up the private property, that means the less people that are going to be on that public land. And so I think coexisting that style within a single person, you know, that you can find a place in all of it that you can enjoy yourself. And like you said, you know, different applications. That's all it is. It's just different applications.
That's right.
You don't have to sell out. I'm only going to hunt public land. That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Why?
Yeah.
You don't have to sell out to, I'm only going to hunt private land. Like,
no.
There are experiences within both that are probably going to fit your needs. You just got to find them. Things like this.
Yeah. And I think one of the things we talk about all the time is how we say this all the time. If you can get on deer consistently in the South, you can do it anywhere, right? We say that all the time on this podcast. And, you know, Parker, you and I, we play sports. Nick, you look like you like to throw heavy things around. So you probably played sports at some point in time. Yeah. You practice harder than you play, right? Yeah. And so if you have public around you and it's really freaking hard and you spend a lot of time when you're on the weekends hunting that, building a skill set, and then you're like, okay, it's time for me to take the next step. I really want to try and kill a big deer. And then you find a 500 acre farm in Kansas that you can be the only guy the first week of November in. Now you can take that skill set that you've honed, match it with opportunity. And what do we always say about luck? Luck is when hard work meets opportunity, right? And so you put in the hard work where you have the opportunity, you buy yourself access to a piece of property that has the potential you want, right? Because 150 ain't out here, not in the National Forest, I promise. You know, I'm with you, Parker. I used to be solely public land largely because I wanted that challenge. Man, my opportunities are limited. I don't have the time I used to. I can't break away every day after work and go watch a cutover to see what direction they're coming from, you know? But the idea of being able to go to Missouri and having a chunk of land they only sell six hunts on, because that's the other thing we haven't really talked about, is a lot of these properties have caps. Like they have built-in caps. They're only selling so many hunts.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
So how's that determined?
Just the landowner, the landowners, again, kind of, it was like, I think it was Parker's first question is, how do you make sure it doesn't get booked 60 days in a row? Mm-hmm. The landowners, and they're just like, hey, this is, you know, population looks pretty good this year. We'll do three hunts or whatever. Right. So,
right.
And we're going to get smarter and better at that. And part of the review system is going to include harvest data. It doesn't today, but this year we're going to roll that out. So now we'll know like, hey, cool. You booked a turkey hunt. It was three guys. Did you guys see animals? Yes. Did you kill animals? Yes. How many? And so we'll have a really interesting data, like real-time data set of what's happening across properties. So there's still plenty of work to be done there. But our landowners today, I mean, again, they're the ones who are throttling this stuff because they live there. Like they've seen good years and bad years and everything in between. And they're like, hey, I think we could do probably three hunts this year.
So I'm going to bring another heavy fastball right down the middle, right?
Let's do it.
Okay. Airbnb, my mom has a vacation rental business. She manages a bunch of different Airbnbs. I watch her fight in the claim system, right? And so it is with Airbnb, just because it's the model where we've referenced so much here, the customer is pretty much in the right, and you better have a smoking gun of like four different video angles of 4K of them breaking the fridge, because all they have to do is say it was broken, it was there, and they just default to that, right? And so I'm sure that's something that you guys are working to figure out. But for the guy who's like, okay, yeah, I understand they said there's a cap. Yeah, I understand this is Kansas and there's a lot of big deer. And yeah, the landowner tells me there's a bunch of big deer. If I go out there, and this is a challenge for you too, because if it's crappy weather, it could like kill a hunt as
it's
well.
Yeah.
But if the guy goes out there and is like, dude, I didn't see 1 ounce of deer sign. Like the guy sent me all these pictures, but I'm gonna tell you, it hadn't rained in 3 weeks. There weren't even deer tracks in the field. Like, how do you handle that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Again, I'll go back to who our landowners are. So some of those scenarios that guys have experienced in the past getting on private were on leases, and just the incentive structures are different. I paid somebody money and I need to recoup money. So I need to sell you. And I'm not saying anything derogatory again about, you know, outfitters or guides or anything. There's awesome ones. And I, you know, I hope to go on some guided hunts at some point in the future when I have more money because I have little kids. But a lot of those experiences, we heard this over the years, like, okay, I want to hunt private. We didn't exist. So you have to go guide or outfitter. And those guys' job is to sell. And so a lot of those types of experiences came from that, like, hey, they're just trying to sell a hunt because they put a bunch of cash out. We have game cameras on pretty much every single property. Now we have a deal with GSM, so we have stealth cam deals, and so we put game cameras out on most of our properties. You can inquire with and talk to the landowners. So like land trust is, you see a property you're interested. This Kansas property's got whitetail hunting listed. You can send them a message and ask them questions. There's a ton of photos on those listings. We're going to be rolling out property updates. So like, landowners can just like update people. Hey, you know, we're harvesting or we're planting or, you know, starting to see deer pop up, whatever. You can kind of like track that stuff. And it really is, if someone gets through all that stuff and it truly is a property that had never had whitetail deer on it, and it's in the history of the world, there's going to be one booking that happens like that. And they're going to be like, dude, there's never been a white, the review that sportsman will give to that property will kill that property. And if it's truly something, we've never run into this, but I just want to say there's been zero instances of this happening. But if that were to be the instance, you know, someone just like listed a parking lot and they're like, oh no, it's great, there's tons of deer, we would refund you your money. Like, our customers and our partners are important to us. And it's not like, you know, that's a small cost to us. But there's a lot of things built into the system. Transparency and trust are kind of there.
So
I love that.
Within that, what are you guys doing? You mentioned the trail cameras, right? Like, y'all have a deal with and you have cell cameras. What is y'all's involvement in each property? Like,
yeah,
are y'all in like feeding proper, like putting feed and feeders or managing any habitat? Like, as far as like land trust, like what is your involvement in each one?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we have what we call landowner success managers. And they cover Montana, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, Missouri, Oklahoma, North Dakota, South Dakota. So we have human beings that work for land trust who will go out and actually visit almost all the properties in those states. Now, we have a lot of properties outside of those states, and so we haven't been on property. But we'll get game cameras sent to them for all the properties in those states. Like, people have been there. You'll see like visit notes from our landowner success managers. Like, hey, I was out there last Tuesday and I saw X, Y, and Z, whatever. And then, you know, it's a really interesting question because we're actually going to be working on it this year. You know, land trust is a platform. Landowners own the land. But it's in our mutual best interest. Our landowners are our business partners. We don't make any money unless they make money, right? So we don't charge them a fee to list or anything like that. We only make money as a commission on a transaction. So again, coming back to incentives, what are our incentives? Our incentives are to make sure that all of our properties are maintained really well and have high quality habitat and wildlife, because that's how we'll make more money. So we're going to be rolling out just a little bit of what we call like a habitat program, where we're going to work with just a handful of landowners and just kind of get this tuned in. But hey, what are some practices that they can do that can create better habitat? And maybe that's, you know, planting some overwinter habitat. So you can like, hey, maybe you have some strips of sorghum or something if you got a bird property, and like overwinter habitat is one of the biggest problems for, you know, pheasants or upland bird populations. Or maybe it's, hey, you take this really crappy piece of production ag ground that you never make money on, but you still plant it anyways. Maybe let's not plant it this year. Let's just do a cover crop there, or, you know, do something or do some food plot there and just leave it be. And so we're going to find, like I said, some landowners across the country, and we're going to start building a program And then we can, again, we're doing it because we'll make more money. Yes, we love wildlife and habitat, but the profit incentive is there, you know? So I think you'll see more of that. Right now, we don't actively, like, this is their land. We don't have anything to do with telling them what to do on their land, and we never will. We'll present them incentives and say, hey, look, it'd be a really good idea if we do this. You're making money with land trust. Let's make better habitat. And we'll work with the, you know, the species organizations like NWTF or, you know, all the different species organizations take their science and say, hey, if you do these things on your property, you'll have better quality habitat for these species.
That's great. That's excellent. That was something, because I think when Walter first told me about this, you kind of imagine like what you got, what that is. Like, these guys are going out and immediately first thought is they're leasing these properties and being able to, like, basically like an outfitter. I in my head, it was closer to an outfitter than it was maybe what you're describing.
What we actually do.
Yeah. What y'all actually do. And so it's interesting. Again, I think maybe for a certain demographic, that might be a turnoff that y'all aren't out there hanging stands and pouring out corn piles. But for our demographic, I would say it's great. Like, everybody's like, yeah, it sounds awesome.
DIY private, right? So it's not an outfitted hunt. It's not a hunt club. It's not any of that stuff. Now, look, there are properties. It's in our best interest to make sure there are amenities on that property that facilitate better hunting. So we do have deals with stand makers, and like, hey, there might be stands on some properties, and you could decide to hunt them or not hunt them.
Yeah.
And we'll get cameras out on properties just so you can see what's going on out there. But it is DIY private. It's you get to talk to those landowners. Again, they understand their properties better than anybody because they live and work there. And you know, I know there's a group of folks out there who want to do the lease because they want to do the food plots. That's awesome. I've never done it, and I don't have the money to do that right now. But you know, there will always be a market for leasing because they want to go do the work, right? They really get the enjoyment, and I respect that. And I'm sure I would love to do it if I had the time. You know, that's a different. You either have to buy ground or lease it to do that. This is for the rest of the market that's like, hey, I don't have the money or time to be able to do those things. I just want to have access to places to go do it myself.
It's incredible.
Okay, so I'm going to take that pause as my opportunity to throw another grenade into this.
Go for
it.
Here's my other thought for you, Nick. And for everybody listening, I'm not beating up on Nick. I'm a big fan of his. But I feel like I have to ask some of these tougher questions because it's stuff you guys are going to just ask us, and then we're going to have him on for part two. And you know, I'd rather part two be like, hey, let's plan a hunt together, right? So here's my thinking on this is I genuinely believe that two factors have caused the biggest decline in private land access. In the Deep South, it's timber companies. We converted all of our private land into rows and rows of pine trees because pine trees make paper and everybody needs toilet paper. And then in really high production areas for good deer, you have outfitters paying exorbitant sums of money because they can charge exorbitant sums of money. And so entire farms got leased. And I know countless stories of, I hunted this farm for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. It's 500 acres. It's got some of the biggest bucks in the county. Facebook came out and I made a post, and then I had 9 guys beating on the farmer's door, offering them 10 grand a year to lease it. Right. And so there it's gone. Combining that thought with Airbnb, it's no longer affordable. It kind of sucks. 5 years ago, it was cheap. It was fun. It was a cool alternative. And now, like you said, candidly, it's sometimes more expensive to stay at an Airbnb that's somebody's shanty above the garage than it is to stay in a suite at a hotel. And so kind of combining those two thoughts, and I know that's a lot, but to me, they're the same thing. How does land trust combat if you start gobbling up property and everybody starts kind of that outfitter thing where people are able to charge more? How do you stay differentiated? Because there will be competitors. Someone else will come out with a, you know, land trust 2.0, and now you kind of have this dueling pianos type thing.
Yeah. So we'll get back. There's some market economics in here. The reason outfitters can charge what they charge is because there's actually a very limited supply. So when you increase supply, prices go down. They don't go up. And just basic market economics. It's interesting. I hear this very often. I love these questions. I like the intellectual aspect of it. Like land trust gobbles up. Well, we don't lease ground. We're simply a platform that enables landowners to directly list. Like Zillow doesn't gobble up real estate listings, right? It's just a platform where people can list their homes for sale. So outfitters and guides gobble up ground because they lease it. And then they're the ones who get to make the decisions. And it's frankly a big reason why a lot of our farmers and ranchers who may have tried leasing before, because it's not like they don't understand there's value to their hunting, you know, access, right? And the only way to do it before a platform like LandTrust was to either outfit it yourself or to lease it out to an outfitter. But here's the big thing. With production agriculture, meaning they farm and ranch for a living, with those landowners, the number one motivator for them is control. Mm-hmm. When you lease your ground, you sold a property right away for a period of time. And most of our landowners do not like that idea. They want to maintain control of their ground, their property rights, their way of life. And we've heard this time and again. Once they lease, they can't use it themselves. Their family members can't use it themselves for hunting. You know, their friends, their neighbors, their business partners, et cetera. So they don't like that. But it was really the only way to make money off it before us. Now we're allowing them to directly participate in the marketplace. And by the way, they're often getting underpaid. Again, purely market economics. If they weren't getting underpaid, there'd be no margin for the outfitter to make money on. And I know I don't mean this to sound like we're against outfitters. We're not. I'm just giving the business model.
No, for sure.
The outfitters made a space for you, actually. I mean, their existence kind of helped you.
I was about to say the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So more land trust properties coming on will actually, you know, prices don't go up when there's more supply. And again, it's actually opening up more opportunity and more access days for more hunters when it's not leased.
Yeah.
So, and it's always going to be up to the landowner. Landowner always gets to decide, right? That's why landowners like us, because they're 100% in control. If they lease, they are not in control. They just sold that right away, and they don't get to say who gets to come, who doesn't, how many hunts you do, any of that stuff. They did get a check up front, and that's nice, but that's where it stops. So, you know, I think that is like, they're just very fundamental incentive structures that differentiate what LandTrust does versus guiding and outfitting and like leasing ground. And it's a big reason why our landowners like it. And frankly, it's better. Like, you would rather have LandTrust come into your local area and landowners list than guides and outfitters, because once they lease it, you don't get, landowners still say yes to door knockers, right? We'll see $2 transactions come through for elk hunts on LandTrust.
Really?
Because it's a landowner saying, hey, it's actually my buddy or my neighbor or my friend or my business partner. They want them to book through LandTrust because insurance, blocking out their calendar, all that stuff, but they give it to them for $2. Right. So they're doing just a nominal charge to make sure that, you know, they have the coverage of LandTrust, but they still can allow anyone to come on their property because they're in control. Just like if you were to list on Airbnb, you can still let your buddy come stay at your house. You know, like you don't have to charge them. So
you block out there, kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly. There are multiple factors there.
I love that answer because that was my number one thought. But again, it's my number one thought because I'm so close to Airbnb. Like I've seen what's happened there.
I was a host on Airbnb in like 2010 in New York City. It's a part of what led me to starting this business, is seeing a shared economy marketplace. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's so much other land out there because of the limited use component to this that you've been talking about. There's so much additional land out there that you're going to bring to market that isn't currently available.
That's right.
You can't put a dollar value on that. Like there are people who might sell. I mean, dude, if I had a chunk of land and I knew I had enough game, right? I'm a hunter, but if I knew I had an abundant game, I'd be inviting people to come out. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, come participate in this thing that I've created, I fostered. If I could sell a couple of those and pay off my property taxes or offset my property taxes, and like you said, have the insurance, because I didn't even think about that part, right? Because that's another huge factor.
That's the first thing every landowner talks about. Because frankly, the reason why you're seeing less and less private land access is because we've become a much more litigious society.
100%.
So like in 1970, you weren't worried about getting your ass sued off the way you are today as a landowner.
That's right. No. I think, you know, when I said the two biggest, those were, I mean, I think that's nipping right there at the heels, right? When we first started leasing land, you just wrote the pulp mill a check and you got your key, right? And they changed the keys every couple of years. And then by the time it was over, can you self-insure? Or do you want to buy one of these products we're selling you? And by the time we left, it was buy this product we were selling you, because they were getting a financial kickback as well. And it just became this like cash grab that just wasn't justifiable. But man, this just feels like you've got a lot of really generous people, and I believe most people are generous, that know they have something that could be special to other people, and they're willing to let them participate, and then they get rewarded in that process. This feels really special, dude.
Well, you know, I appreciate that. And I think, you know, some people think like, well, if you paid for it, it's just a transaction, there's no relationship. I can tell you, maybe with a timber company, okay. I would say that's probably true. A fair statement. You're probably never going to meet anybody from the timber company. It is just a pure transaction. You'll notice a theme here. Because of who our landowners are, there couldn't be anything further from the truth. Yes, you're paying them for the opportunity to come out and enjoy this resource that they steward day in and day out. But when you read reviews on land trusts, like go click through some listings, read reviews, both parties just like talk about how much they enjoy spending time with each other, meeting each other, all that stuff. There is a transaction, of course, but it is absolutely relationship building. And we see people who I literally read reviews like, we'll be friends for life. You know, and they're, you know, so it is not just this financial transaction, like with this nameless, faceless thing. Like, yeah, maybe a timber company, that is much more the case. But because you're who our landowners are, and these are people who live and work there, relationships are central to the experience that Land Trust provides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're selling a community much in that, you know, SoCo, the Southern Collective, we are all about community. That's what we want to foster, because everything we talked about, hunting camp has died in the South. I think by and large, it's a fair statement to just say it's gone. It's just not on the landscape in the sense of like the vast majority of it is gone. It feels like very much like what we're building over here is very synonymous with what you're building, which is, yes, like you said, there's that transaction, but you kind of have an inherent tie. You care enough about that property to have a connection with the landowner who cares deeply about his property. As somebody who grew up with a lot of land growing up, we had 1800 acres. I was a spoiled brat. I would have people come out. I'd invite them out to come hunt, and they would just be so just elated to be a part of that experience. Yep. And they were so appreciative. And I was raised to be grateful, to be appreciative and recognize what I have. I'm like, yeah, dude, isn't this freaking awesome? And if you were a good dude and you picked up your shotgun shells, you were coming back the next time, you know, you can come shoot the dove hunt with us again. And, you know, I've got buddies. One of them's in Washington. I haven't seen him in 6 years. He sent me a picture of me and him in a duck hole one time on that piece of property. And it's like, dude, if we still had access, he and I'd still be going there. We're you know, bonded by that experience and that piece of property. And I've gone through the reviews. It's really interesting by how you've cultivated a resource. It's very non-toxic, for lack of better words. Like, it's not just transactional. It's like this really cool community experience.
And it's not outcome oriented. I mean, some of my most fond hunting memories, we didn't kill anything. You know, right. It was about camp. And truly, like, if I'm being honest, where I'm at in my stage of life right now, like, I'm going for hunting camp. You know, it's like, go with some buddies or whoever and just like spend time outdoors. And camp is probably some of the most fun part of it. It's like creating those lasting memories that, you can text your buddy 6 years from now and be like, dude, remember that? And it was a great time. If you get to kill an animal, awesome. But it really is about relationships and experiences rather than transactions and outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, there's so many turkey hunts.
Barker, you got anything? I know.
I'm planning my next turkey hunt while you guys are talking.
We literally have guys last spring who, like, you'd see one guy and you'd see like six turkey bookings come through, and they'd be like, you'd just be doing a big loop around states, you know, like, yeah, we need some, by the way, we need some Osceola properties. We have a couple Florida properties that are like in the process, but we have no, you can do your grand slam on land trust, generally speaking, if you don't need Osceolas right now. We're working on it, but.
If you've got,
we have a huge Florida base, so somebody's going to pick that up and run with it.
I know.
Oh, by the For turkeys, just if you go to the homepage, landtrust.com, and you scroll down, you'll see a turkey section, like, you know, like a, and we actually have all of our properties broken out by species or subspecies. So if you click on that, you can go and you say, I want to, you know, I want to go hunt a Rio or Merriam's or whatever. We'll have all of our turkeys properties broken out by species.
So cool, man.
Or subspecies, I guess. I'm not a scientist, but
it's a really neat opportunity. It's very unique, I would say. Mm-hmm. And props on the website, man. It's very easy to navigate and figure out the things that you're, I mean, it's awesome. Just, I'm blown away, yeah. Man, Nick, it's a really cool company. I love the idea. And I think a lot of people are going to benefit from it. I look forward to seeing how it grows in the future, because I think it's great.
Well, I appreciate it. And as the founder, I'm always our product's harshest critic. So it is nice to hear that it is easy to use. Like, I look at it, I see like 50 things I want to do, but you know, I'm very close to it. But I would say, Walt was mentioned earlier, to anyone listening, if this is marginally interesting to you, create a free account. And when you do that, you say like, hey, I'm interested. By the way, there's other stuff like fishing, you know, like just general outdoor rec. People use us to shed hunt and forage for mushrooms. And there's like farm and ranch experiences. But when you create your free account with us, and you say you like hunting, then we ask you like, hey, what state do you live in? What states are you interested in? What species are you interested in? And then, you know, Walt can speak to it, but like, he tells us, you're telling us exactly what you like. The moment we bring on new properties that match those interests, we send it to you. Like, we're not spamming you. We're not sending you stuff you're not interested in, but you told me you like Montana and turkeys. There's a new Montana turkey property. Here it is. It's brand new. So mm-hmm. like, we're essentially scouting for you 365 days a year around the country.
Freaking incredible.
Yeah. There's some really sweet like opportunities. And I'm going to be honest with you, dude. I'm very much a generalist. If there was one thing that I do well in life, it's turkey hunt. That's like that's the only thing I ever, and Parker can attest to this. I've told him 1,000 times. The only thing in life that I wake up every day confident that I can at least participate with some measure yeah. of success is yeah. turkey hunting. But I'm building a 600 yard rifle. Well, my second 600 yard rifle. I've got two of them being built, right? I want to go hunt some of these species. It might take yep. me 10 years to get the points for. And in 10 years, my knees are going to start freaking hurting, right? I mean, it's going to be harder to do some of these. When you go on land trust, there are some of these hunts where it's like, yeah, you can primitive camp on the property. You got 2,000 acres, have at it. And it's like, dude, like, that's my jam. Cause you know, I'm going to pull up, you know, my mapping app and I'm going to scout. And the idea that Parker and I can affordably buy an out of state tag and let's just pick a random state and go hunt mule deer. Like, that sounds like fun, man. That sounds like a lot of fun. And you can do this with some degree of regularity instead of having to like worry about point creep and like, okay, well, somewhere between and this just happened to a buddy of mine. He's like, somewhere between 5 and 7 years, I'm going to be able to do these three hunts. And then he drew all three of those hunts in the same year. And yeah. so he's got an Alaskan moose hunt. He got a Arizona mule deer hunt. And then he got a Utah bighorn ram or something like that.
No
and he's
way.
Like looking at it. Yeah, dude, it was
unreal. I'm going to buy a lotto ticket, man.
maybe it wasn't Utah. I mean, but it was literally one of those, like, he calls me, he's like, I can't believe I got this. I'm like, dude, that's awesome. Like, you know what you're doing this year. And he's buying airfare and everything. And he calls me, he goes, dude, I'm the luckiest guy alive. I just got this third one. My wife's going to kill me. And I was like, just tell her
divorced after this season, but
yeah. Yeah. And his wife is like, well, we'll find the money for the second one. The third one comes and she goes, what are we going to do? And he's like, I don't know. But like, I'm never going to get these tags probably again because of these factors.
Yeah.
And they figured out a way to pay for it. But I say all that, as always, long-winded as hell. I say that to say Parker and I could very easily just book every couple of years, whatever hunt it is, big hunt we want to do, put it on the calendar, save for it. And as long as you can get a landowner tag and you, as a non-resident, you don't have to go into a lottery still, let's yep. have it, you know, and that's exciting.
Well, we're about to roll out, it's not in the next few weeks here, buy now, pay later too. So you can book something and do a little buy now, pay later. Don't tell your wives, but,
yeah.
So it's the same guys that do buy now, pay later for like Daniel Defense and some of the big kind of gun industry guys we're going to be working with. So,
That's awesome.
We have trip insurance. So, you know, just like if we're trying to make a lot of the same offerings. So you can, if you're going to book that big hunt in the very near future, you'd be able to do buy now, pay later, but you also can add trip insurance too. So if whatever happens, you can get your money back. So we're trying to make it a really easy thing to be able to do and, you know, give you some of these things. We're playing with the idea of tag insurance as well, but more to come on that in the next two quarters.
It's awesome, man. I gotta say, I'm stoked about this conversation and people hearing it. I think we're going to get some good feedback from it. You mentioned quite a few things, like I heard you say multiple times, like that's something we're doing this year. Sounds like this year there's a lot of new things that are going to be rolling out for Land Trust that people can look forward to.
Yeah.
Where would they be able to kind of keep up with all those new things?
Well, yeah, the best way to keep up is just create a free account, because then you'll get emails from us. And we don't spam. I mean, I love Sitka, but my goodness, those guys send out like freaking 10 emails a day. Like, we're not going to do that to you, I promise. So, yeah, just create a free account. That's the best way. You can follow us on social media. It's landtrust_hunt. And those would be good ways to do it. Yeah, there's going to be some bigger products and feature that we release this year. One is going to have to do is just kind of like showing you all the over-the-counter tags across the country. So, I mean, literally what Walt was just talking about, like, hey, I want to go hunt mule deer with Parker. Where can we do that?
When's that go live, you say?
That's going to be, we don't have an exact, but in the second or third quarter this year. And that'll just be a free resource for anybody. So we're building out the database. It's mind melting to go and read all state regulations and actually like structure it into a database that's usable. So it'll be a really cool tool. Just like, hey, I want to go hunt in the state. What can I do over the counter? Like, did you guys know you could hunt cow elk here over the counter right now in Montana? You don't need a draw.
No,
I think I did. Yeah.
Well,
I have a friend from church that went and did it, like two years ago, maybe a year ago.
So it's stuff like that. I found opportunities. I found over the counter opportunities in my own home state that I didn't know existed. You know, so like just kind of like uncovering that stuff and making it more accessible for people. That's going to come a little bit later this year. We're going to have a premium subscription that's going to come with some cool stuff in it. Not just gear stuff. I mean, everyone does that, but there will be gear stuff, but more platform specific. It's going to be a big year of new product. And then buy now, pay later will be, I don't know, potentially in the coming weeks.
That's huge, pretty dude. Insane. That's awesome. Well, listen, I imagine we're going to hear you back on the podcast at some point in time. I've actually got a couple ideas for just fun podcasts we could do using Land Trust. So I'm
going
to
hopefully they involve us going hunting. Yes. Then I can tell my wife it's for work.
So you're the one that knows the landowners, man.
I have to do this.
Ball's in your court.
Yeah. I'm contractually obligated.
I killed my first turkey last year.
Really?
My first turkey ever killed. Yeah, in Missouri.
That's awesome.
I went down with, you guys know John Dudley?
Yep.
Heard him. So
I went down there with him. I used a shotgun. I'm like, dude, I need to kill the bird. If I get to be around a bird, I need to kill the bird. And so he obviously did not use a shotgun, but we had a phenomenal hunt on a Missouri property and just awesome landowner. Amazing time. He had like seven bass ponds on. So by the way, did you know you cannot hunt turkeys in the afternoon in Missouri?
Boo. You
can only hunt till like 1 p.m.
1 o'clock.
We didn't know that showing up. Yeah, we didn't know that showing up. So, but it worked out fine because then you go like bass fish on the ponds and like have some beers and barbecue, whatever.
That was a thing. A lot of those states, a lot of Midwestern states have that. Alabama on public now has that. We've got to be
really?
Done. I can't remember if it's 12 or 1. I think it's 1. On the public land. Yeah. You can't hunt past a certain point. They did that like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
2 or 3 years ago.
So I recommend if you're looking, find a place you can hunt that has some fun fishing or something else. Yeah. So it actually worked out really nicely, but yeah, it was a fun one. I shot my bird, after a crazy windstorm and rainstorm on a little cut timber road, 63 yards, like full spot and stock, which yeah, I don't know how to call birds. Like, you know, well, yeah, I'm the opposite of you. That was my first bird. I don't know shit about
it. I don't know what I'm doing either.
Spot and stock. stone and like, you know, like literally crawling through mud on my belly to get close to this bird, and I shot him at 63 yards. And I didn't know that there was another Tom with him. As soon as I stoned him, the other Tom came out and started attacking him. And I'm like, I wanted to let Colton, who was, works here too, to get a shot at him, but it just didn't work out.
You got the full experience, man. You got to see the flogging. You got to see everything. And then you learned probably why people like us like turkey hunting so much.
It's amazing. So I get it. I get it for sure.
You should definitely come down to Florida and hunt with us, man. We've got some terrific.
I agree.
Well, we're going to recruit you some private Florida land, but our public land hunting down here is terrible. It's terrible.
Don't do it. Yeah.
wait till the private land listings come available on Land Trust. But I have a feeling we could have some fun together. And you get an earlier start to your season, because I think your season doesn't start until late April, right up there.
Yes, I want to say late. It's late April. Yeah, I want to say that's probably right.
It's like March 16th down here.
I'm telling you guys.
Dude, I want to go down there. I want to go down there and fish. I love fishing too.
It's okay.
I've hunted both places. I've hunted Montana and Florida, so I can tell you where y'all should go. Y'all should go to Montana. That's definitely where you should go. But Florida's fun too. It's just so hot, man. It's so hot and everything wants to bite you. Like,
I do not. Yeah, I think that's a great point. I do like it up here. We don't even really have mosquitoes. I mean, you can find mosquitoes in parts of Montana, but not like we don't have them here. I don't ever run into them.
You can put your foot into the middle of a blowdown in Montana, pretty much. I mean, I know there's some rattlesnakes around, but you can just walk through thick stuff and not have to worry about bugs or snakes. That's pretty cool.
I like that.
First time I went to North Dakota, it was early season in September, and I was like, is there ticks? I was like spraying permethrin or something. They're like, you don't need that. There's no ticks out here right now. They're gone. It's like, is this heaven? Have I died and went to heaven?
Yeah. Hey man, North Dakota is a cool state. We got a bunch of properties on there, and we have some cool pot, you know, kind of prairie pothole stuff for waterfowl guys. And
that's cool.
It's a cool state. Yeah.
A lot of cool states, a lot of cool hunting opportunities all over the United States. And I think this is a great opportunity for people to see those, to utilize Land Trust and be able to plan their next adventure, man. I think it's great.
I appreciate you
coming on, man. Yeah, this is a blast. And I hope you'll entertain us soon and come back on for another part at some point.
Yeah. Let's do a hunt camp one.
All right, man. Until next time, guys, it is almost turkey season. Get out your diaphragm calls, get ready, go book you a hunt at Land Trust, and we'll see you next week.